board. Mm-hmm. This was in the 80s.
Yeah. So similar to this board, but electronic? Or?
Yeah, well, it was like a keyboard, mm-hmm. and it gave a voice, a synthesized voice, and a printout of what he said. But what happened was that it totally upstaged him.
Oh, yeah.
Like, people were much more interested in the technology than in what he was saying.
Yeah.
And then also, like, when he does this now, you end up guessing half of the stuff he says, you know. You get R-E-A-L, mm-hmm. real, really, you know.
Yeah.
Well, people would just kind of hang out and wait for the voice to say the whole sentence, which means he had to type every single letter of every single word.
And a computer in the end cannot interpret it. That's, you know, like, in the end, the best things in the world are organic.
That's right.
That's your sticker.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All my life, people have tried to get me high tech,
okay.
B E because they think high tech is better.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. Yes, it doesn't work for everything.
Like H O U houses.
Like houses, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. We can talk about that, about high tech and low tech and houses.
We are now talking about it.
Okay, we are talking about it. Yeah, let's talk about high tech and low tech and houses and there's a tendency to, many clients want a house to be completely kind of maintenance free and take care of them, you know. Traditionally, houses and people take care of each other in a way. Mm-hmm. It's like an interesting thing when you talk about the finish of a house, for example, the plaster. And that's something we deal with very often because we use alternative building materials like straw bales, for example. And then the plaster of the building is like the skin of the house. Mm. And everybody's used to having cement stucco because it's completely maintenance-free. It's not entirely true what it means. You don't see what's happening behind it, and mm-hmm. there's something going on in houses when moisture gets trapped behind the stucco. If there's a crack, for example, mm-hmm. the wood behind the stucco just rots away.
Mm-hmm.
And so a typical situation when somebody remodels a house and you open up the wall underneath the window, everything mm-hmm. is gone. It's just, you know, the dry rot took all the wood away. Because that stucco doesn't breathe, it doesn't let moisture get out quickly enough, and so in very old houses there used to be other types of plaster, lime plaster, for example. That's a different material which needs maintenance, like every few years. Mm-hmm. Like if you look like houses that are 500 or 600 years old in Germany or Austria or Italy. People would just whitewash them, like every 2 years, maybe every year, maybe every 5 years.
I lived in Germany.
Oh, you lived in Germany?
Yes.
So there are these very old houses, but people don't understand that old houses. If a house is 500 years old, it's a story. It has a history of 500 years of maintenance, moderate maintenance, but it's very. It's very different in kind of modern construction. People want to build something and hope that it's completely maintenance-free, but then it's in the end it's sacrificial. After 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you know, it's just completely destroyed and you tear it down. I mean, the average commercial building, for example, I can't give you the exact number now, but you know, like a mall has a certain lifespan, and after that, it's outdated, and they just get torn down, and then the building material goes to the landfill, which is a big problem. So it's not a culture of repair; it's a culture of disrepair, and then you know things get discarded. It's almost like consumerism, you know, where you buy something that's wrapped in plastic and you toy and you use it, and after that you throw it. First of all, you throw the packaging away, and then you throw what's in it away after maybe a year later when you're tired of it, and then it doesn't get recycled. You know, it's not
like,
part.
Like we are having to repair
replace
W I
windows.
The windows that were put in here are all rusted and mildew, and you can't clean them. They're all funky. Not the W. The wood is fine. The wood is fine. You know, you just kind of deal with that. But it's this, what is it, the aluminum? Some kind of aluminum.
Like aluminum sliders or something?
No, it's just you know the all that. It's like a double pane glass, but it's aluminum as the you know the part that the glass is in.
And so the frame is
it's all rusty, then it gets like all this mildew and stuff that you can smell that you can't actually get to clean.
I
don't know how you would clean it.
People.
Think M E metal is you use the metal instead of the wood because it would last longer or something like that. Whereas, like the wood windows are still there, the ones they didn't replace.
No, that in general. For a window, I would say it doesn't make a big difference whether it's wood or metal. Metal windows probably last longer, some metals you need to paint. If it's a steel window, for example, like an old industrial window, those you know are typically painted. You know, like the Golden Gate Bridge is painted. You know, and this reddish anti-corrosion paint, but. With windows, the trouble is how they get put into the building. If they are not put in properly, and moisture accumulates on the edges of the window, and it doesn't drain out, then it gets trapped somewhere in the and around the window perimeter, and then you know it creates rust for the window or decay of the wood around it. But you know those are all very special questions. It's like like details.
Right.
It's
specifics. I L I lived in N New Mexico.
In New Mexico?
Where A D Adobe.
Adobe, The nice thing about Adobe and not only Adobe, but all natural building materials is they are not difficult to maintain and to build. Basically, everybody, you don't need very special tools. You don't need very skilled labor, like years and years of training to be able to handle them, because they are very forgiving. You know, you can you work with your hands and you use and basically Adobe. Is in part of that kind of earthen natural building material, and it's very often it's like a spectrum. Earth and straw, those are materials that you hear very often in the same sentence, and it's always a mixture. How much earth is in it, and how much straw is in it? Like Adobe, for example, is like this very large brick for those in the audience that don't know what it is. It's a very large brick that gets formed out of earth, like clay-rich earth and straw, and then gets formed into that brick that gets then dried in the sun, and when it's ready, it basically gets stacked up to form a wall. It's like a super masonry block, if you will. Mm. And well, and it lasts very long if you keep it protected from the rain, so it doesn't have a nice roof overhang. It's going to stay pretty much forever. Mm-hmm. And even look in San Francisco, for example, the original mission in San Francisco is a very old Adobe building. It's the oldest building in the city, and right next to it, they built the new mission. And it was barely completed, and then the earthquake of 1906, it just fell over. But the old mission right next to it, you know, didn't take any damage or hardly any damage because it was just built to deal with the situation that there are earthquakes. I don't even know if they knew about that when they built it, but they built it, you know, with a good deal of common sense, and they made the base of the wall very wide, and then they had it kind of tapered, so it's a very strong form. And the material, you know, if it has little cracks in it, it doesn't really matter. It's kind of, in a way, it's almost self-healing. And very, like a lot of building materials, like, let's try to go through the spectrum of earth and straw. You can just take earth and ram it. It's like rammed earth, you know. Basically, you need a formwork, and then you take earth and you compact it, and that, you know, is a fairly stable wall. The problem in California is with earthquakes. If you build a house, you need to add some cement to it to make it kind of stiff enough. Without doing that, you would in an earthquake risk that it's very brittle. It would just fall over and harm the people in the building. So it's a great material in areas that are not so seismically active.
In New Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in New Mexico it's good.
Some time in they be you build in to a H I hill.
Into a hill, yeah. There's if you build into a hill, that's called it's an earth berm. You have the building connected to the ground, and and there's also the term of an earthship. That's a technology where people basically carve a building into a hillside, like ideally a hill that's facing south, and then so basically the north and the east and the west of the building are pretty much enclosed and are in the ground, and the ground gets one prevents the ground from kind of falling into the building by stabilizing that cut into the hillside with tires, so the tires get stacked up and filled with earth, so so that the hill doesn't push over into the building. And then the south side of the building has a lot of glazing to it, and that means that in high desert climates the trick is to balance the extreme temperatures during the day with the extreme temperatures during the night. Mm-hmm. Basically, in desert climates, it's too hot during the day, too cold during the night, but on the average, it's just perfect. So the only thing you need to do is use this flywheel effect where you store the heat, the excess heat of the day, and kind of suck it into the earth and into the heavy material, which is called the thermal mass of a building, and then design the building such that the excess heat that gets taken out of the day gets then released during the night to keep you warm. So basically, if you do that, you're fine. And it even, I mean, in most of California, that works very well too.
Even in the
In the winter, yeah.
In the winter.
Even in the winter. Yeah.
It was warm.
It was warm, yeah. You need, It does not work in every climate. If you are up in Alaska or in Canada, or even like if you go much further north from here, it doesn't work either because you simply don't have enough sun. It's really how many, and then the temperature of the air is not that important. It's more about how much sun do you get, you know, in the winter. Do you have enough sun hours? And if you have enough, then you know that's a very good approach. There are these two basic approaches: working with thermal mass, where you do this flywheel thing, or insulating. And insulation is clearly something you need to do when you are in a climate that has a long heating period. Like, let's look at Canada, for example, where you have like long winters, long nights. Very often it's overcast. You don't have this, you know, like blue sky over you every day, like you have in New Mexico, for example. Mm. It's and then and if that's the case, then you need to make sure that you bottle up the heat that's inside the building in the winter, you know. And our area here, the Bay Area, it's somewhat of a mixed climate. You know, you have to apply both of these strategies. But our firm built a house in Berkeley on 9th Street, which is a small cottage, like 950 square feet or 900 square feet, with straw bale walls, which are like 2 feet thick. And it's a two-story house. So on the downstairs, there's just one open living room and kitchen and a little pantry, and then you go up the stair. Upstairs is one bedroom, a little study, and the bathroom. And the owner-builder who built that house wanted to do everything himself because it was just his thing to work with his hands and get his own house together. And he also put the plumbing in. So there's a hydronic heat, like a hydronic heated floor on the first floor. It's like basically a concrete slab. And then you have these tubes going through the concrete slab, and then you can heat the slab in the winter to keep you warm. Well, unfortunately, he didn't know enough about the plumbing, you know, so he mixed up the valves and things. And so in the end, that heating system doesn't work. It doesn't pump water through the slab. But fortunately, he doesn't need it because the house he moved in 3 or 4 years ago, he never had to heat the house. It's designed in such a way that it captures enough, warmth even in the winter. So it stays warm in the winter and it stays cool in the summer. That's what is referred to as passive solar design. That means you don't have any machines and pumps and collectors. It's just by the positioning of the windows and the distribution of the window, like the size and distribution of the windows, and also how the light that goes into the building needs to be heavy surfaces, you know, like a concrete slab or tile, and the walls are plastered, and that you know, then you have this good combination of thermal mass and the insulation that allows this building to heat and cool itself without any mechanical systems.
S. So, why are not all
houses
new
like
buildings
that?
Put together like this?
Yeah, I think it's part of the thinking that you build something and then you have some sort of a machine that it's probably the notion of having total control about everything all the time. And not allowing nature to do its thing. And so I think people want to be able to have a display and push a button and say, now it needs to be 72 degrees or something like that. And if things are more complex than pressing a button and then having a machine condition it right to the very point that you want to have it, it's suspicious to a lot of people, I think. And I think that's a fundamental flaw in thinking, and that's what's at the root of a lot of problems and environmental deprivation and resource depletion and all of those things. And I think also about, you know, people kind of being disconnected from nature or something like that. And if you have solar hot water, for example, that's the greatest thing you can have. You know, the sun warms up the water and you take a hot shower. I think that's very, very rewarding, but you know, hardly anybody has that experience because the typical house doesn't have it, and every house could have it. Every house, or if you were very serious, or you don't have to be very serious about it. In most of it, the technology is available, and it's not much more pricey in the beginning. A house could generate its own electricity. It could generate its own hot water. It could be completely passive in terms of heating and cooling, and that is true for this area. It's not true everywhere. If you live in Minnesota, you definitely need an auxiliary heat source. So, but overall, one really asks. I think it's a matter of the political priorities.
Even there, mm-hmm. in Minnesota, you could use mm-hmm. L less.
You could lose, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think what's important to understand, and that's something where, like, architects and planners are really a challenge to, rethink their, like, responsibility and also their potential impact doing something about climate change, and because if you look at where the energy goes, like in a typical industrialized mm-hmm. economy, about a third is transportation, cars driving back mm-hmm. and forth and goods being shipped around. Another third is like the industry, like manufacturing goods and factories. And the other third is private residences where people mm-hmm. live, but now if we look at the industry, like half of that, mm-hmm. that third that is allocated to the industry is the buildings of the industry, mm-hmm. the heating and cooling, the factories. Basically, people spend half of their life in their homes and the other half in their office, unless people, the folks that work from at home. So if you look at that equation, then basically half of all the energy and all the resources mm-hmm. are related to buildings in some way or another. So it's a huge impact. Mm-hmm. And if everything was done to lower the ecological footprint, if you will, of those buildings, we wouldn't have a problem with not, with having to import oil or with pollution of rivers and the air and all of those things. It's an enormous factor, and unfortunately, it's only now that it's really getting on the agenda somehow. And but it's very slow.
Not in the U.S.
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly this mm. government doesn't care about that. But there are, there are like movements among the professionals, like architects. Green building is taking off to some extent. There are there's a rating system that got introduced about a year or two ago. It's called the LEED system. It stands for Leadership in Energy and Energy Efficient Design, which is basically. When somebody builds a house or like a commercial, now it only works for commercial and institutional buildings. They are working on a residential LEED system too, and this system is basically assigning a grade to a building in terms of how green it is. Because everybody can build something and say, "Wow, that's pretty green," but you don't really know until you look at it a bit more thoroughly. It's like how much energy went into building it. But not only that energy aspect, but also how much water does it use? How does it work with its site? I mean, does it take care of its own like stormwater runoff, or does it have to rely on a sewer system? And how much does it encourage public transportation? Using public transportation or is it pedestrian friendly? How much of the surface does it seal? All of those things. It basically really looks at a wide range of factors that are important for being green, and then in the end, a label gets attached to it. It got like a just a regular LEED rating, or then there's a silver rating and a gold rating and a platinum rating. It's a little bit silly at this point, but and it's pricey. People that want to have a rating for their building, it's a larger planning effort. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of bureaucracy. You know, like our firm has one lead project that we are currently working on, and it's an enormous paperwork to get that all done. Mm. And you have to ask yourself, why are you doing it? It's a good question. And it's a lot of
And why is there so much paperwork involved?
Well, for example, if you let's give you one example. If you want to, for example, say that you are using like a sustainably harvested wood. You know, that's the idea of buying wood that has a certification as being as coming from a forest that's well managed. So a forest that's not clear cut, and then everything gets turned into wood products, and it leaves nothing behind. And then the topsoil is carried away by erosion, and there might be no forest after that at all. Or, you know, a forest that is not anything compared to an old growth forest in terms of like a habitat and an ecosystem being wiped out completely. A sustainably managed forest has a completely different characteristic. So it's only a certain amount of wood taken out at any given time. So not to destroy the system, only take as much away as you know, as so that the ecosystem can recover and stabilize itself. So, and if you want to, for example, if you want to just focus on this sustainably harvested wood, you can't buy it everywhere, and you really have to follow through. Where can you buy it? Where does it come from? It tends to be more expensive. Does it have the right certification? And where was it harvested? How much transport is involved? Just researching the building products that go into a building, that's a really big job. And then you have to do a lot of like calculations, and for example, if you look at your surface materials, how much water can percolate through the surface and replenish the water table underneath. For example, if you have a Walmart parking lot, or whatever, like a big parking lot that's all blacktop, all of the water just basically goes into the storm drain and then out into the bay in this case. So that's, of course, a problem. If everything was covered with blacktop, and then all the water would be let into the bay, I mean, apparently, mm-hmm. that's not good for replenishing the mm-hmm. water table and the aquifers underneath. And if you have a large site, you know, there's a number of alternatives that, you know, you can use, like a parking lot, for example. Doesn't have to be paved necessarily, or paved with a material that doesn't allow water to go through it. But if you do that, it's not, most of these things that are environmentally friendly are not standard building practice. Right. And so whenever you do something
that seems to me the main thing, it's what people are used to doing, so there's a whole system set up that makes it easy. And if you're doing something that's not set up, it just takes a lot more work.
And many things are not common building practice because of the economics of how a building gets put together. If somebody had like a longer view in terms of the cost benefit, the life cycle analysis of a building, then everybody, for example, would have a solar heated water system on the roof because it pays for itself after a few years, and then after that you get free hot water without using natural gas or propane or electricity to heat it. But it's an upfront cost. When you build a house, you have to have that money in the beginning. If a developer builds a house, the house gets pricier because a number of those items that make sense in the long run or even in the medium run don't get put in, so the house can be thrown onto the market very cheap. And the utility bill that the buyer or the tenant later have to pay, well, that's not the problem.
Right.
That's not the problem of the guy who builds it in the beginning.
Right.
And I think working all of these economics into the process to come up with a solution that is good in the long run, that's the challenge.
We are you running out of time?
Yeah.
In T terms of B O both G,
gas,
L, O, global warming, and R, U, running out of O, oil.
Yeah.
And C, O, coal.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of everything, and I think the biggest problem, the severest problem, I think, is the fact that ecosystems get destroyed at this very moment. Global warming. I mean, we might say, well, you know, it's getting nice and warm everywhere. It leads to terrible climate change, and people, I think, really underestimate that. If
1, 2, 12, THO, 1,000 in F R A France.
Yeah.
Died with the heat.
Yeah. And, you know, that's really, things are happening that, you know, are pretty unbelievable. For example, the glaciers melt at a rate that's unbelievable. And I think our generation can probably get away with it, you know, and especially the industrialized world, if it gets too hot, people just crank up their air conditioning. But the deserts are spreading at a very high rate. The pole caps are melting, and there's a hole in the ozone layer. All of those things that are beginning to develop now, it's all heading in a pretty steep downhill spiral. And I think that's why change needs to come very quickly. And
But 1 R E A reason for the B L A blackouts were A.
Air conditioning. Yeah.
W. H. I. Which could be M. U. Much. L.
Less.
M. O. More. Much more. E.
Efficient or?
Efficient.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Efficient or, you know, to some extent, I mean, that's a very unpopular statement, but I think if you can't take the heat, just, you know, move somewhere where you feel comfortable living. You know, I think the whole business with the air conditioning, you can really get a very long way in terms of designing a building properly, so you don't really need air conditioning. And I think unless things like air conditioning can be fed by renewable energy sources, you know, I would just turn them off. But it's, of course, you know, that's not how society works.
But I saw in 10 to 20 years, we will get 10 degrees hotter.
Yeah. I mean, the climate change. If you think about what's happening since the industrialization, when, you know, mining of coal and oil started to feed industries, what's happening, it's the all the fossil fuels got built up over millions and millions of years and are stored in the ground, and now they all get brought, they bring them up to the ground and they get burned. And so basically that's like a quick release of all that that carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, that is built into these fossil fuels, and they all get thrown into the atmosphere in a very short time. And that's why it's very important to seek different energy sources, renewable energy sources. And but it's very, very tough to make the transition. The transition needs to be made very, very fast. But, you know, already people are talking about reintroducing nuclear power, which is also a big, big mistake. Mm. Nuclear power may have the advantage of, you know, not generating carbon dioxide, but it has other problems. There's no...
S-A. The same people.
It's the same people.
Who are in the... Into oil.
Into oil, yeah. And I think one of the like key strategies should be to look at what are the local resources. For example, North Dakota, the wind energy over North Dakota, if you were to harvest it like in an economic fashion, you know, like putting like wind power, like propellers, wherever, you know, that you have high wind speeds, North Dakota alone could supply all the electricity of this country, of the U.S. And it just needs to be done. And then, of course, it probably wouldn't make sense to have the electricity all centrally generated in North Dakota and then transport them around. That doesn't make sense. You have to look at what are the local resources. In sunny areas, you use the sun.
D and E C E decentralize
yeah. And I mean, it's also it's also tied into, you know, like a sense of how should democracy work. The problem of a nuclear power plant is that it creates like a high security area within a society, and I mean that takes you into the discussion about terrorism. It's a target for terrorists, apparently, and it's a high security area. It creates a very, very big concentration of energy in one point.
But it is high P R O. Profile?
It's high
profit. No, high profit. But it's high profit. It's high profit.
Yeah. It's let me give you a report of what's going on in Germany right now. In Germany, 2 years ago, the Green Party is part of the government in Germany. The Green Party developed out of basically a grassroots, several grassroots groups in the late 70s and early 80s, and then they formed a party. And if a party has more than 5% of the vote, it can go into the parliament. It can form a fraction in the parliament, and it's so. If you compare it, like for example, to the Green Party here, it will never really. It's very, very difficult for like a new movement to be represented in big politics, because big politics tries to keep them out, and very successfully keeps everybody else out. And to the extent that candidates from other smaller parties, smaller meaning that they may still represent 5 or 10% of the population, but still they wouldn't have a voice on TV or in discussions. And I mean, recently the race for governor, that, you know, was interesting, that, you know, the Green Party person there, you know, was able to give his opinion to like a larger audience. Typically, it's kind of this exclusive thing between the two big parties, and everybody else is kept out. And that's slightly different So in Germany, with the 5%, they made it into parliament, and they were in the opposition for many years. But you know, now they are in a coalition government with the Social Democrats, and they really pushed a lot of environmental issues through the legislation. Like there's like the long term, it's the long term rejection of nuclear power. I mean, the power plants that are working currently can still basically keep going, and you know, for a limited time, as long as they are safe. They, you know, it's basically to allow it like a transition to other energy sources. But at the same time, wind energy got promoted. Currently, 10% of the electricity is generated by wind. It's a booming industry, and it created a lot of new jobs. Mm. And the target is by 2010. I believe going up to 25%, which is amazing. It's really, and you see like you see these wind generators popping up everywhere. It's also like a, like some people say, well, we don't want to look at wind generators everywhere. It's not that they are everywhere, but you know, they are part of the mm-hmm. landscape now wherever there's higher wind speeds, and there's other ways, you know, like finding mixes, and you can also put them offshore. You know, it's done that they put them in the North Sea. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, wherever there's kind of, the water isn't that deep, you can just put a wind park out there and it generates a lot of electricity, and you know, nobody has to put up with the sight and the noise that they make. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so there are, what I'm getting at, there are, a lot of progress has been made by having the right people in a government. And I think a lot of those goals can only be achieved if there is a political understanding of the seriousness and acting upon those issues. The most offensive thing I believe that I as a foreigner experienced in terms of U.S. politics is not signing the Kyoto Protocol, and then as an argument saying that, well, the U.S. won't sign the Kyoto Protocol because it's not good for the U.S. economy. I mean, that's not the point. The Kyoto Protocol is not about being good for the U.S. economy. It's about, getting a grip on global warming.
It is R, really, G, good for a U.S. economy, and it is really good for U.S. economy. It is not good for CO corporations.
Yeah.
WHI, which are two DODI different things.
Yeah, it's, you know, the tie between, you know, like the fact that like most of the renewable energy sources don't really lend themselves to this large kind of capital concentration. So, if you will, then there's
that,
no lobby for it.
They are DECEN. Decentralized.
I mean, there are things, even
WH, which means MA, which makes it harder to MO monopolize.
Yeah. And you know, and also, I think there are ways of making it kind of friendly enough for you know, the the industry, the bigger industries, and that or these existing monopolies to jump onto the bandwagon. And it's happening because Shell.
Why? How? No. Yeah. Why? Do. Why do that?
Well, I think it's you know, in kind of pragmatic terms of how can you solve that as quickly as possible. It's just changing the political framework and, you know, giving different guidelines. For example, catalyst converter, when they got introduced to Europe, I remember that exactly. It was the industry said, well, it's impossible to achieve that in that given time frame. It's completely impossible. And then politics said, okay, you just need to achieve it. Here's a deadline. But then, you know, all new cars that that can be sold on the German market in that case need to be equipped with this particular, like, three-way catalyst converter. And of course, it was, you know, it wasn't a big deal. It was easy to accomplish that. You just have to set a political framework for it. And the same would be true for fuel efficiency standards for cars. Mm-hmm. You could just say, okay, you know, these cars need to be 30% more fuel efficient by 2 years from now. If you don't make it, then, you know...
In reality, it was...
Declined.
It was P-O... S possible.
It was possible.
30 years ago.
Yeah. The you know, the, like, I think there's this is such a complex subject. It's very hard, you know, to kind of stay focused there. The I mean, one of the things is fuel efficiency, you know, like how many miles per gallon do you get? And, you know, there are cars that get 60, 70 miles per gallon, and they are there. But in the end, that's kind of mediating the problem. You know, it means it's less of a problem, but still a problem. Mm-hmm. In the end, you need a completely different way of thinking. You need to find a resource that is renewable. And that's way more complex. I mean, an ideal, and because, you know, basically all of these fuel efficiency standards, even if you were to push them through really, really hard, they would probably not be able to keep up with the increased traffic. You know, like mm-hmm. then cars get 10% more or 50% more efficient, but at the same time, people start driving 20 or 25% more. Yeah. So it's like it's still going into the same direction.
Well. Need. You will need to. S-H. Shift. The. S-O. Society. To. S. M. Small. And. Local.
Yeah, small and local. And, you know, I think overall all the human activity ideally should blend into natural cycles. If we look at the fuel issue, for example, there are alternatives. For example, you can grow fuel. You know, every diesel engine can be run with vegetable oil. You could just run a diesel engine on canola oil, and that's completely... CO2 neutral, because the CO2 gets absorbed by the plant, and then you can press an oil out of that, you fill that into your engine, and it burns it, and then the CO2 gets released. It releases CO2, but the same amount that previously was absorbed by the plant. And that's different with fossil fuels. You know, the fossil fuel, that's plant that were around several million years ago, and in enormous quantities, and that all gets quick released right now. That's what's causing the problem. If you do it in cycles that are like complete loops, it's not really a problem. Of course, it's very tough to make that transition because, you know, you would have to grow a lot of canola to get enough canola oil to fuel the enormous need that this is an industrialized society has for energy.
F A. Face it. If we are R E A really S serious.
Really serious.
We there are ways.
Yeah.
There are ways like F R E free P U public transportation like P H P U public T R transportation that is 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that's of course something works in like we're in larger concentrations, like urban areas. I mean, if people like live further in the country, it covers part of the problem, and it's great. I bought my first car when I was 31, and that's when I moved here. Actually, I was 30 when I moved here, but I never had the need for a car. I always use my bicycle, and I still use my bicycle. I just, you know, use the car on occasion. So my daily commute, and it's really like, you could say it's a matter of your preferences and choices. You know, it's up to everybody to live.
No,
not everybody. It's, you know, of course, you know, there are. I think it's very hard to make like rules for people. You have to live like this or that. It's not.
A, if you are, if you are P O, if you are poor, and L I living. In the P O poor part of town, you can not be bike. If you are poor and living in the poor part of town, it's not practical to bike.
Well, I used to live in Oakland till last year, and I bike to work every day. It's 8 miles. The work is in Berkeley, and it was going through some rough areas of Oakland. I mean, but it's, you can do it, I think, you know. But you know, the thing is, I don't want kind of push people and say, hey, you have to do this or that or that. I think it's a larger shift in paradigm of, you know making it I think it's just What are the standards of a society kind of develop gradually? I think it's just, you know, and I don't know how they get created. You know, it's probably through, you know, there are, for example, if you watch TV, there are so many car commercials. They really create this illusion that people define themselves through their vehicle, and it seems people don't really seem to mind to sit in traffic every day. It's like I couldn't imagine you know, doing like a commute to San Francisco every day, sitting on the freeway. It's this never-ending stream of cars. But there's a lot of people really seem to enjoy that. You know, they're sitting in their huge cars, and that's their moment of peace or whatever. And there must be something wrong in that picture, I think. It's I think if overall society were to shift to be more pedestrian, more bicycle friendly, you know, live as close as you can to your work, and you know, just setting different priorities and making them not only acceptable but desirable.
R E free P public transportation 24 hours a day?
Yeah, it can help. And for example, in
it is M more than can help. It is more than can help. It is being C O M M I committed to changing yeah. things.
I mean, I think
I N instead of C U cutting S E R service and raising the price,
yeah.
which is what's happening yeah. now.
Let me give you an example. In Sweden, there's a number of cities that that are kind of tourist attractions, so people go there. And so what they do is they have parking lots on the outskirts of the city so that people wouldn't have to drive downtown. And if you still want to drive into the city, you have to pay a relatively high fee. But also, with this fee that you pay, you get free. With this fee, you get public transportation. So you can use any kind of public transportation, and so it's basically like something. Okay, you have to pay anyway, and with this paying, you know, you can use our buses and streetcars and our subways, and so that's an incentive for people to say, okay, well, why should we fuss around and use the car? I think it's very difficult, and I'm not a specialist in that in terms of the economics of free public transportation, and I think it's just an enormous step. I mean, I would think it's great. To do that, but I think it's very tough to implement that.
No. It was like that. It was like that mm-hmm. before.
Yeah.
Public transportation was free before. Mm-hmm. Or very cheap.
Very cheap. Yeah, I think
24 yeah, hours.
I think the very very cheap is for me intuitively the better way to go to make it. I think it's important that it's, you know, all day and every day, and that, you know, it really works. It needs to be as attractive so that people would really use it. If you're sitting there and if you have to wait for a bus for 45 minutes, it's going to scare people away. So it really needs to work. And but that's, you know, how most European cities work. In European cities, it's so easy to get around with public transportation. And actually, San Francisco, the Bay Area works pretty well as long as you live close to BART. If you're further away from BART, you're in a desert.
No.
No. Yeah.
After...
If it's late, yeah.
Yeah, after yeah. midnight, yeah. which yeah. a lot yeah. of, you know, we're yeah. involved in that, so we're yeah. really mm-hmm. aware of yeah. how limiting, like people mm-hmm. that would take BART to events say, mm-hmm. well, you know, I guess I'll have to take my car because yeah. Yeah. it's yeah. cutting it too close.
Yeah.
S. So, the P, O, the poor, R, S, stuck.
Mm-hmm.
The R I the rich take their car.
Mm-hmm.